Well, we're much more familiar with the account of Jericho than many other battle narratives in the book. This has to be the most well-known of all of them. In fact, if you saw the email that went out, you may have been reminded that we had a two-part study even less than a year ago as part of our Great Things, Great Acts of God in the Old Testament class. That was February 27th and March 2nd. If you weren't here then or couldn't be here to listen to those, I hope you can actually go back and watch that. We have video of those classes. Some of the key points covered during that class would be as follows, and I guess I'm thinking in particular about the Sunday morning class. Luke did a fantastic job then breaking down this text and covering the details. So there was the discussion about the appearance of the commander of the Lord's army in chapter 5, verses 13 through 15. There was a discussion about the concept of holy ground. And there's the image of the commander with the drawn sword, and how that must have been inspiring to Joshua. There was the great discussion about the walls of the city, and if you go and watch that class, you'll see actually some images, or at least some images of what those walls could have looked like. God's plan for victory. We'll talk about that some today. There was focus on the shouting in the text and the study of the word translated shouting. Again, these were all things covered less than a year ago. A consideration of the numbers in the text. What numbers are in the text? Yeah, the number 7 plays an important role. The number 13, there was some mention of that, referring to the idea of something new. A discussion of the trumpets. Trumpets appear in this narrative. They have some significance, of course. God's confidence in his plan. Then, you know, some of the, I guess, the themes or points of application. God's confidence in his plan. Everybody being involved. All the people were involved, right? At Jericho. That's impressive to us. Men, women, and children. Everybody had a role. And likewise, we have a role in growing God's kingdom. We'll talk about Jericho again, being the first of the kind of the first fruits of the land. God saving his people, our trust resting on God's confidence. My purpose in bringing all of that up is not necessarily to rehash all of that. I don't really intend to cover those points again in detail. Instead, I'd rather encourage you to go and listen to those. I'd like to see if together we can find some other things in the text that we can talk about today and Wednesday. But you might be left to wonder, after I've just regurgitated all of that, what is there left to discuss, especially over the course of two additional classes? Well, we'll talk about a few things tonight. I have a topic that you'll see at the end that I'd like to talk about on Wednesday night. But before we get into that, just again, what themes or you know, from your previous study of this, which would have been for some of you less than a year ago, what hit you afresh as you read the text again? What impressed you? What stood out to you as you read this? Edra?
I was impressed with God's plan.
Yes, God's plan. He minded every detail. He was in control of every aspect. What specifically were you thinking about? Just what impressed you about God's plan?
He just told them everything that he wanted them to do.
Yeah.
He didn't leave any doubt.
Told them every detail? Absolutely. Okay? What else? Yeah, Angie.
Well, just Joshua and the people's complete dependence on God is something that
yeah.
really strategy-wise, didn't make sense to do.
That's a mild understatement, isn't it? More than a mild understatement. A strategy, it doesn't make sense only to us. But I got to tell you, it's weird. Jericho wasn't that big of a city, and at least 1 million people, maybe more, marching around that. I was trying to picture as I went back and actually listened to Luke's class. I don't know if I've seen any images that would really truly represent that many people. I mean, I think Jericho maybe held, what? I've heard estimates of maybe a few thousand people, like maybe 2,500, 3,000 people. It was about 10 acres in size, one estimate I saw. That many people going around that relatively small a city. Fortified as it was, impressive as it was, it just wasn't the size of Kansas City. It was an important city, it was a strong city, but relative to what we're used to today and thinking about a big city, it just wasn't that. So 1 million people going around this. One would have thought with that many people, with that many soldiers, there are plenty of other ways to take this city besides that. But he has the city conquered in a way where there's no doubt about how this came about. But it was strange to human eyes and ears, no doubt.
I think the size, if you think about the last day, they marched around the city 7 times.
Yeah, 7 times.
That gives you an idea that it probably wasn't that large.
Right.
Of a city.
Right. I think I remember Luke sharing an estimate. I could be misremembering this. Something like 30 minutes maybe was all it took to get around the city, or an hour, whatever it was. But yeah, there would have to be enough time to make that circuit multiple times on the seventh day.
Look how many people.
Yeah.
You know, that's the issue.
Yeah. And it wasn't the Israelites' physical conditioning he was concerned about. They were plenty conditioned enough to march however many times God wanted them to. So the number 13 comes into play when you have six, once a day for 6 days, plus seven on the seventh. So there's how the number 13 gets into it. Okay, other thoughts? What else stood out to you? Larry?
The walls came tumbling down, yet Rahab and her family were still in their residence, which we were told was on top of the wall.
Right.
So somehow,
yes,
maybe that section or something remained standing.
Yep.
So that they could be rescued.
Yep. Yep, that's right.
Another miracle within a miracle.
Yeah, I think I remember reading something about various excavations that have taken place at the site. And of course, there's disagreement about dating. Was this Joshua's Jericho? But at one point, there was noted that there seemed to be some places along the wall where there were residences that survived whatever tumult hit the land at that time. Kim, did you have your peripheral vision here?
Battle.
Yeah.
And I think that we learned that in this chapter.
Yeah.
That, you know, Joshua is just, and the people are supposed to submit to the Lord's commands there.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Lord's battle. What makes Jericho unique in the book of Joshua? What things about this battle are, besides being the first, What things about this do you see as different from the other conquests that the Israelites will engage in at God's instruction? All of them are at God's instruction, so that's not what makes it unique. But what stands out to you as being unique? They're all God's battle. I mean, a lot of the things we've said, some of the things that have been said would apply to all of, you know, Ai, Hebron, Libna, all the other cities we're going to read about, especially in chapters 10, 11, 12. Darren?
This time he just wanted to take the silver and the gold. Sometimes he'd say he'd take the animals. So this was a little different. Just take the silver and gold, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, just take the silver and gold. I'm going to go over here and get my notebook. Other thoughts? So you're saying that's unique to Jericho?
I'm not sure if it's unique specifically to Jericho, but there's certain times
he can
take certain things.
He doesn't always do that, right? There were times when they could take the spoil, but not always, okay? Chris?
There are a lot of cities devoted to destruction, but I think Jericho might have been the only one where there was the curse as far as saying it couldn't be rebuilt.
Ah, okay.
And it seems to be kind of almost a first fruits situation as far as the
land. Sure, first fruits of the land.
Yeah.
Joshua places a curse upon it, whoever rebuilds Jericho, and then, of course, later on in history, someone does at the expense of, I think, his youngest son. Is his name Hiel? For some reason, the name Hiel is coming to mind. H-I-E-L. Okay? Sorry, keep going while I scrounge here. Well, I was wondering about that. I mean, the Ark of the Covenant is playing a very prominent role. I mean, it's always has a prominent place among the people of God at this time. It led the way across the river, chapter 3. It features prominently in the narrative in chapters 3, 4, and 5. And here again in chapter 6. But there aren't too many places after that in the book of Joshua when... when the Ark of the Covenant appears. In fact, timing could not have been better. It features again in chapter 7. It's mentioned again in chapter 7 and verse 6. And then again in chapter 8 and verse 33. And then the next time I could find in my Bible when the Ark is mentioned in Judges chapter 20. Interesting. Does that mean the ark didn't go out in front of them to battle again? I'm not sure I can answer that. If it was, it's not mentioned. This is Bible study, right? So we can kick some things around. What if this was the only time the ark went out? What would be significant about that with regard to Jericho? I mean, there are other things about the conquest of Jericho that to our eyes were strange. As we're reading it. Phil, what do you think?
It seems like there's a whole conditioning of the children of Israel through this whole process, including God is among you, represented by the ark. God is among you, represented by the shofar, the sound.
Yes.
That whole thing seems to be signaling this. Again, this is God's battle. This is God's victory. This is God's action. And so he's conditioning them as well as then conditioning everybody that will hear about this. You're in trouble. So it's a whole first step to the conquest. And dramatic, it's about as dramatic as you can get. So I think that's a message to both sides.
To the people inside the walls, to the people outside the walls, to the people inside other walls that Israel will come across. It certainly seems like what happens at Jericho sets the tone for everybody involved. This is who we're dealing with. This is who it's like God's announcing himself to the entire land. This is what, so in other words, what you heard about me is true. And then some, right? Sometimes we hear, we hear about things and the stories are embellished. Nothing about what you've heard about me, God's saying, has been embellished. If every fantastic thing you've heard I suppose there's always things they could have claimed about him that weren't true. But in this case, I mean, God does things beyond imagining. God does things that blow your mind. God does things you think, how is that possible? It's back to the expression that doesn't occur too often in the Bible, but the Lord, he is Lord in heaven. Remember what Rahab said? And on earth. He's Lord over all. So back to your point, Angie, about the ark. I mean, the ark, the significance of the ark in chapters 3, 4, 5, and probably also 6, to Phil's point, is he's employing the ark as a vision, as a teaching tool. Is that really the right way to say that? I mean, he is in effect using the ark to teach, isn't he? I mean, he certainly doesn't require a gold box. If he wanted to be in front of the Israelites, the gold box is there because God prescribed it. That's its significance, right? It's the presence of God that's of importance. But that visual certainly would have been impressive and impressed important lessons on the minds of the Israelites. And of course, the people inside the city, chapter 6, verse 1, says the city is shut up. I mean, they don't want anybody coming in, and they're certainly scared to go out.
These people have probably, Jericho's seen siege attempts. They know what that is.
Oh, sure.
People around their city trying to get in is probably not an unusual thing in history. But people doing it with a golden box, they'd be like, what in the world is that about? And
right.
In the trumpets, there's something different about
these
folks.
Yeah. A golden box and trumpets and people marching in silence. I mean, when's the first time they make a peep? When they're told to shout on day 7. I'm not a psychologist, but I would imagine that was some sort of... that would have weirded me out. I mean, just the silence of the people beyond the trumpets. Why aren't the people shouting anything? Why aren't there any chants? Why aren't there any war cries? This is as much almost a religious exercise as it is a military exercise. Other thoughts about Jericho? What makes Jericho... You have your hand up, you're just still thinking. Okay, you still thinking? Okay. Danny?
I think about it being more of a spiritual mindset.
Yeah, previous generation tried that after they realized they were going to be punished by wandering in the wilderness. That didn't turn out well. Yeah, the very next city they're going to go out and they're going to think God's with them. They're going to find out they were wrong. Yeah. Okay, very good. Larry.
I wasn't going to say anything, but as you study this and you study about the commander of the Lord's army, I don't remember another battle where this occurred.
Mm.
I remember with Balaam, remember that he stood with the sword drawn. It was an angel.
Yeah.
But if this is Commander Lord Army, are we not talking about an angelic host?
That's my assumption.
So he's not talking to a
right.
person.
Right.
He's talking to God in this form that he recognized as a military person, right? I don't know. I just, all these.
He has every appearance of being a commander of an awesome army, sword drawn in his hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's got to be angelic host that he's commander of that army since we're talking about God.
Angels often appeared as men. This, in my Bible, says a man was standing opposite him.
Yeah.
That's the best conclusion I can draw. Would not be dogmatic about that. I would be hard-pressed to, okay. This gets into the angel of the Lord and... Is it Jesus? Is it
I just don't remember.
Not sure.
The battle where
yeah.
the commander of the Lord's army was.
Right. Right.
So that would make possibly this a difference.
Yeah. Well, this would, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Even though everything was under control, he was there to show Joshua
right.
that he was with him, I think.
Well, and so this raises an interesting point. Let's say this is the only time the commander of the Lord appears to Joshua. Is this the only time the commander of the Lord is involved in a battle? No. Not even a little bit. If God goes out with them, there's another army fighting. Another army took down this wall. We just couldn't see it with our eyes. That's just, you know, that'll make the hair stand up on your neck or your arms. Yeah. Yeah, Dave.
I was thinking back, and I don't know. It says that Joshua tells them not to rebuild the city of Jericho.
Yeah.
And it'd be cursed if they did. I don't remember. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't remember of any other place where they say not to do that.
Right. 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 Yeah, I can't think of another one. Can't think of another one. So there's the first conquest. It's the gateway city to the rest of the land. There's the role of the Ark of the Covenant in the account. Only city I could find where the instructions for conquering are like this. And really, I mean, in many ways, Jericho symbolized everything that the previous generation would first bring up. You got fortified cities, you know, strong people. Talks about the, you know, the land devours. Anyway.
Yeah, I was comment? Really thinking that it would also show them that God has not forgotten his promises to them that he made, even
yeah.
though he made them hundreds and hundreds of years ago back to Abraham.
Yeah. Yeah, not only does he, I'm going to piggyback off that thought and offer this. God not only doesn't forget his promises, when he shows up prepared. There's not a detail God missed. He's got his army there. He's given his instruction. He's in complete control of every aspect of this. He's not ever caught, you know, flat-footed, as we might say. That indirectly demonstrates a remembrance of his promise and his full plans and intentions all along to fulfill those promises. He's been planning this. He's been planning it all since the beginning. And of course, from a messianic point of view, there are greater things he's going to bring about. Through all of these things. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think another interesting thing about it that sometimes can be missed is because especially when you see, you know, visualizations or people making it like art for you to see what it might have looked like. A lot of times you see like these crumbling walls, but if you actually look in the verse, the method of the walls falling down is just another way that it shows only God could have done that. Because if you read the verse, what it actually says, it doesn't say the walls crumbled down or the walls broke. It says the walls fell down flat.
Verse 20.
That's not really something that could have been done through normal methods of siege. You could
have
brought walls down flat like that if you were just attacking
yeah.
the city in a way that a normal army could have. So it shows,
right.
again, the power that God had to do it in a way that would not be expected.
The walls fell down flat, yeah. Yeah, good. Chris?
I think it's kind of interesting how the world looks at this. Some archaeologists say that, no, this didn't happen this way, that there was a river that came up too high and actually dissolved the wall. So it's interesting how humans don't want to go by the Bible. They want to go by, well, I think this river probably was too high, and the wall just kind of melted away. itself, they even mess with the Bible that way.
Yeah. Okay. Some people are going to search for any other explanation for
right.
something except God, because once you allow a divine foot in the door, that's a game changer. Okay? One more thought. Go ahead.
Falling up on the vault, walls falling flat, usually they build a siege wall.
Right.
Siege the building, and there's one section generally of the wall that goes down, not the entire wall.
Just enough to get in. Yeah.
Whereas with Rahab, her section remained.
Yeah.
So I think that's different
yeah.
to me.
Yeah. Yeah, God's not doing this at all the way human generals would have drawn it up. So from the standpoint of themes, again, that's not the right slide deck. That's not the right slide deck. We need session 7. So here's the three of them are on there. We can start out with this. The fear of God is, again, a prominent theme here in Joshua 6. We see it from verse 1 onward. God, back to Phil's point, God is instilling fear in the citizens of Jericho. In fact, we already know that's been the case all the way back in chapter 2, right? And then when they cross the Jordan, the text mentions the fear. Chapter 5 and verse 1, it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. There's this repeated going back and emphasizing the impact that Yahweh is having upon the nation. So he's instilling fear in them. And of course, in a healthy way, he's instilling fear in his people. In fact, the next couple of chapters in our study are going to reinforce some lessons for them along those lines. Any other thoughts about the fear of God? I see that being another important theme, a recurring theme throughout these chapters. We've kind of already talked about that. Here's another theme that recurs. The presence of God, right? We've talked about that. We've talked about a unified, obedient Israel. A unified, obedient Israel. I think he's cultivating that as well. Not just a unified nation, but an obedient nation. Again, everything that he does in chapters 3, 4, and 5... of course, also everything he did with the previous generation, all collectively serve to unite this generation of people around important principles, around the holiness and majesty of God, around the need to obey his instruction, around the need to trust in him unconditionally. And we see Israel coming together as one nation. And they indeed are going to be a unified, obedient people. Another important questions or comments about those things? We've talked about those. Tim?
This is a generation that has grown up seeing the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire. Every morning they go out and pick up food off the ground.
Right.
And completely dependent on God for their entire adult lives. So they are conditioned to know that God's there. He's active in their lives. He's not just
right.
Remote source of instructions or whatever.
Right.
So this is kind of reemphasizing that in a very dramatic, visible way here, being at the conquest.
it's hard to imagine, actually it's really not, that they would, I mean, every day you go and pick up manna, you're almost living life on autopilot a little bit, you know what I mean? You get used to what the norm is. I mean, when you sit back and think about it, how could you ever get used to that, you know, food falling from the sky, God's provision. But then, but I do wonder about, you know, the day, and we just talked about it in the previous section, when the manna stopped. I mean, how many, I don't know how many consecutive, and they do the math, how many consecutive days that would be. But normal has just been redefined. And so yes, they've been trusting him for that, but now they've got to trust him afresh. And there's got to be a lot of conversations in homes. I mean, I think God alludes to that fact when he talks about children asking questions about what this means and parents sitting them down or grandparents sitting them down and talking through those things. As all of this is happening in the camp, conversations are happening with homes. And what message does God want to be prevailing in those homes? The need to trust God. He brought us this far. He gave us his manna. Now we've got to trust him afresh. That's what God wanted them. Wanted the conversation to be like within the home. That's fascinating to think about as we think about our homes and our time and the uncertainty that surrounds us. Great lessons for us to fear God and trust him. And other thoughts, other comments, or otherwise? Can't find the file? Onward. Make sure the sermon file's there, though. Because I have my laptop. I can re-upload if I need to.
Doesn't that suggest that the faith is shifting? Now it requires more action. It doesn't require sitting back.
Yeah.
Trusting while sitting back. It requires trusting while going out into the unknown. That,
yes.
That's a different kind of deeper faith that they're being called to shift to.
Yeah. Not sitting back, maybe going in, you know, outside, you know, in your area in the camp to pick up your food and kind of keep to yourself. Now it's, they've got to walk by faith a little bit more. In ways they never even had before. Darren.
Just noticing, we talked about before, the strong faith of Rahab to be able to go through all that, and she knew what was going on. That would have been a really tough time for her, knowing that they're going to attack.
Yeah.
Faith that she was going to be saved, and she did.
Yeah.
She got her father, mother, and brother also.
Yeah. She doesn't, the whole time. Those 7 days, where's she at? Where's Rahab? In her house. You can hear that, you know. I don't know how much she could see out her window. I mean, I guess. This procession, I'd imagine there were, you know, until the procession was done, there were probably always people. You could look outside the wall and see people. I mean, they've just surrounded the city. But she stays in that house. Yeah, she's a big part of this story. So is Achan. He doesn't show up in the text until chapter 7. But there's his whole thought process during this. And somewhere along the line, his mind goes awry. And he begins to rationalize things he ought not. And it leads to tragic ends. Chris.
And speaking of Rahab, too, you know, she didn't know how the city was going to be defeated, so they're marching around, and then all of a sudden the walls fall down. But they had to still stay in the house. Like, if the wall falls around you, you might be instinct to get out of the house.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Do I bail? I mean, you think when the wall's falling down flat, to the brother's point, it's going to make some noise, isn't it? I mean, on day 7, there's finally noise, and once the noise begins, there's a lot of it. There's shouting, ear-piercing shouting. There's the blast of trumpets. I mean, not in this order necessarily. The walls falling down flat, and then the chaos, and they're staying in the house. The cord's still out the window. They're waiting for God's deliverance. Think of the faith that took on her part. That's exactly the kind of faith God wanted all of his people to have. That was really walking by faith, even though she wasn't doing any walking. She's staying put where she ought to. Okay, a couple of the other themes that I wanted you to think about. With a couple of minutes left, we don't have time to develop these, but these actually go with Wednesday night, so it all works out. The concept of Yahweh the warrior. We've talked about that, right? We've as much as talked about it today. This is Yahweh's war, Jehovah's war, God's war. He's the one fighting it. Israel's participating in it. But this is God. We know about the unseen army, the commander. This is his war. Wednesday I want to talk about Jesus the warrior. Because there's a war being fought today. So we'll talk about that concept of Yahweh war. We'll get into maybe a little bit of the concept of harem, H-E-R-E-M. It's a Hebrew word that means utter destruction. In this context, refers more to the idea of devoted to the Lord for destruction. That's a part of this narrative. We won't necessarily connect that with Jesus' war. But those are some things I want you to be thinking about, and we'll get into that in chapter 7 as well, because as there's a ban here on taking items as plunder, as booty, and of course Achan's going to neglect that command, that instruction, and it's going to cost him everything. So be thinking about those. Any other thoughts or reflections on Joshua 6? As we said at the beginning, it's a well-worn place in our Bibles. I don't know what the soonest, what the earliest point in your story is when you first heard the story of Jericho. I'm guessing it may have been in a children's Bible class and flannel graph was involved. But what would we do without flannel graph? It's a timeless story. It's not just a story for kids. It's not just a story for VeggieTales. It's a story for grown-ups. We never outgrow these stories. So we'll talk about another one in our sermon today. All right. Well, we'll just hit the pause button right there. Thank you all for your great participation, and we'll look forward to continuing this on Wednesday.